Well, for those of you who might be just joining us, we've been working our way through the first epistle that Peter wrote to the early Christians. It was one of the earliest documents, and it was written to a group of believers that were basically jogging all over the Middle East and Roman Empire, escaping persecution. So it's written to those who were scattered across, who were experiencing persecution, who were experiencing suffering and difficulty, and he's writing this to let them know how they should live in light of these difficulties that they were facing. One of the things that comes in really handy when you're on the run is a place to hide out. And Peter writes this letter, and in it he includes a line, "Be hospitable to one another without grumbling." The reason I think he had to throw in that "without grumbling" line is someone once said, I think it was some of our founding fathers, that fish and visitors start to stink after 3 days. So having these people hang out at your place while they're on the run might have caused some difficulty. They might eat your food, drink your stuff, break your furniture, do all kinds of other nasty things. And as a result, he had to throw in this admonition. Biblical hospitality is our topic, and how to extend it so that you enjoy it is our discussion. The first time I can actually recall experiencing biblical hospitality is Jill and I got married. We were going to this church, been there just a little while, and a young couple with kids came up to us after this service and said, "Would you like to come over to our house for lunch?" And we thought, good idea. So we followed them back to their place, and we walked into their place, and it looks like they were not at all expecting us. The place was a mess. There were a couple diapers left over from, sure they just had to change it before they ran out that morning. The place was another chaos. There was, no food ready, whatever. And eventually, the place got a little cleaned up. Food got on the table. We ate and talked and actually had a great time. And in retrospect, I am really glad that they invited us because they ministered to our need. We didn't need a place that was cleaned up. We didn't need a phenomenal meal. We needed some biblical fellowship and some Christian fellowship and encouragement, and that's what we got. And that's what biblical hospitality is all about. It's not about entertaining a la Martha Stewart. It's more about meeting God's needs in another person's life. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how that happens. And then I'll get to the grumbling part because it's always good to talk about grumbling. I did a lot of it this week in practice because I didn't have my DSL. But so now I know some of the negative effects of grumbling. Let's start out with something like a definition. Biblical hospitality. The word for that's translated hospitality is actually stranger lover. Stranger lover. It's not having your friends over and having a good time watching the World Cup. It's really not biblical hospitality. Stranger lover. Now, I realize unless your friends are really strange, it doesn't work. But it's doing this. It's using God's resources to accomplish God's purposes in the life of another. A lot of us, when we interact with other people, are trying to get our needs met. Oh, you're such a wonderful hostess. Oh, you're such a grace. Oh, such a great gift. But it's really not about us. It's about using God's resources to meet God's purposes in the life of another. So what are God's purposes? Now, sometimes God's purposes might be entertainment, sustenance, delight, and all that. Misan gave, didn't know I was going to talk about this, but gave a great definition of what she experienced this week. She, praise God, I'm part of a body where people observe my needs and are generously sacrificial or something like that in meeting them. Because in order to observe a need, you have to be thinking about another person. A little bit of a sacrifice. You have to take your eyes off yourself. And then to actually meet it, you have to sacrifice as well. It's actually a sacrifice with which God is pleased, as we're going to see a little later. In order to practice biblical hospitality, you need to have your needs met. So later in James, there's a thing called the royal law, the law of love, liberty. And it's basically summed up as, my relationship with God meets my needs, so I'm free to meet the needs of others. It's that simple. We cultivate a relationship with God, we get our needs met, and then as we interact with others, we're free to accomplish God's purposes in their lives, not our own. Most people, when they reach out to someone, it's really to meet their need, to feel important. I was exposed to a codependent relationship this week, and it wasn't pretty on either side, where one person needs to be needed and the other person needs someone, and thinking, what's the dynamic of this relationship? You know, why is this person going to heroic efforts, yet treating the person that they're, you know, serving so miserably? Well, it's because their needs are being met. They're also passive-aggressive. There's like a whole Psych 102 course in there about even psychological behavior. Anyway, we need to cultivate a relationship with God that meets our needs. So then we're free to think about, well, what is this other person's needs and how can I meet it? And using God's resources. It is an expression, Roman numeral 1a, of other-centeredness. And there's this guy called Jesus, a couple thousand years ago. He said this in a sermon he gave on a mountain, quoted for us in Matthew 7:12. He says, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them. For this is the law and the prophets. It's called the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you, as it frequently gets misquoted. But basically, it's thinking about, if I were that other person, what would I want? And then giving it to them. It's not difficult. It's actually rather simple. And believe it or not, this sums up the law and the prophets. It's like all the law is summed up in this simple thing. Be other-centered. Of course, this, you know, being God-centered is prerequisite. In Hebrews, the author writes near the end of his letter, he says, let brotherly love, Philadelphia kind of love, continue. And then he says, and don't forget to practice hospitality. It's entertain strangers. Sorry. And he says, for by so doing, some have unwittingly entertained angels. In the Homeric Greek thought, there were lots of stories, or culture probably, lots of stories of gods visiting people. And you find this actually in Asian cultures, Indian cultures, there's all over, gods walking the earth. And non-Western cultures have a fairly deep tradition of the responsibility to entertain strangers. And it's not just entertain them. You know, show you my magic trick, tell you a joke. No, it's not that. It's involve things of provision, guidance, protection. You might remember Lot in Sodom. You know, the extent to which he went to protect the strangers from the men of Sodom. He was willing to sacrifice his own family for that thing. And the people that he was entertaining, they're angels. So there are things like that happen. But in the Greek thought, that lots of, like Zeus, there's a name for Zeus called Stranger Zeus. Xenios Zeus, that Xenon is xenophobia, it's hating strangers, fear of strangers. This word is philoxeno, which means love them. Zeus actually had a name of the stranger god, and it kind of reinforced the idea in the culture that you entertained and took in strangers and protected them. And instead of feeling threatened by them, you experienced, you shared love with them. The author goes on to say, don't forget to entertain strangers and also remember the prisoners as if chained with them, those who are mistreated, since you yourselves are in the body also. So, particularly in the early church, and this is true of a lot of spots around our world, people are imprisoned for their faith, and visiting them and being concerned about their needs is also an expression of this idea of biblical hospitality. He goes on to say at the end of chapter 13, verse 16, but do not forget, just like he said, do not forget up in verse 2, this is kind of the bookend at the other end of it, don't forget to do good and to share. So basically share your resources and needs with others, practice hospitality, for which such sacrifices God is well pleased. Two little points on that. It is a sacrifice. Sacrificed cost. Stuff that you could use for yourself, you don't get to use. But then the other piece is God is pleased when you do this. Therefore, you have the motivation to make the sacrifice because you want to be pleasing in God's sight. Because he's the one who ultimately has all the goodies.
Just share your needs.
Share your stuff.
What about sharing your needs?
Well, God meets your needs, so you don't have to share the needs with others. It's nonsense. That's another sermon on that one. on transparency and communication. In Romans 12, when Paul is writing about how people should interact in a body, kind of the practical part of Romans, like as if the sanctification part of 6, 7, and 8 wasn't practical, but when he gets to the nitty-gritty of how you should interact, and he talks about gifts in the body, and actually Peter is talking about how people should interact in the body, he's going to talk about gifts in the very next verse. He says in Romans 12:9, let love be without hypocrisy. Hate what's evil. Cling to what's good. A love that kind of overlooks everything and says, oh, everything's wonderful, is a hypocritical love. And we talked, Peter talked about that last week when he said a fervent love that overwhelms a multitude of sins, not sweeps them under the rug. Cling to what's good. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love. In honor, give preference to one another. Don't lag behind in diligence, but be fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. Rejoice in hope, be patient in tribulation, continuing steadfastly in prayer. All those things are core values of the Christian life. If you remember Garrett's sermon on all the commands in the New Testament, these are some of those one another passages, things that believers are supposed to do with one another. Now I want you to notice, and I'm going to do this a couple times through the sermon, with the same level of those things, God puts distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality. Bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse. If you ask, like, what's one of the hardest things to do in the Christian life? Well, bless those who curse you. Curse them back. Don't take vengeance. That's really hard. And being steadfast in prayer, well, that's really hard too. Look what's right in the middle of them. Being hospitable, meeting others' needs is sandwiched right in there as one of the top things that should happen in the Christian life. And it's really the mark of a person who's matured in the Christian faith that they're reaching out to others. It's not all about them. It's how does God want to use me to accomplish His purposes in another's life? So this is the reason why I say it's a grace. We're ministering God's grace to one another. It's going to happen in the next, if you look at 1 Peter 4, it's going to show up a couple verses later. We're good stewards of God's grace. We use what God's given us to bless others and build them up. Last week or so we looked at, or a couple weeks ago, we looked at fathers and the requirements of elders kind of fit in underneath that. And both sections of the New Testament talk about the requirements for elders list hospitality as one of the requirements. And I want you to notice what it's listed with. 1 Timothy 3:12, an elder or an overseer or a bishop is supposed to be blameless, vigilant, sound-minded, thinking his life according to objectives, orderly, following through, hospitable, able to teach. Notice where it fits in? It's like right up there with some of the really important stuff. Titus 1:8, be hospitable, a lover of good, sound-minded, just, holy, temperate, and being able to hold the truth so you can teach others with it, especially those who are going to reject it and refute it, or try to refute it. So this stuff this requirement on us is a significant one. And we kind of tend to think of hospitality as, oh, well, if it's convenient, I'll do it. That's more self-entertainment, not biblical hospitality. Three things I think are useful for extending hospitality, and then one line on what it takes to be a good guest, recipient of hospitality. The first is sensitivity. Being sensitive to the needs of others, which requires you to think of others rather than yourselves. Being other-centered. The key to good relationships is being other-centered, not being self-centered, not being all wrapped up in yourself, but thinking about what does this other person need? If I were in their shoes, what would I want? How would I want to be treated? We would like it if other people would think about what we needed, right? But don't we need to go and think about what others need? And not just be this little self-contained unit, like a beach ball, but something that is more far-reaching. So you need a sensitivity to the needs of others so that you're aware of their needs. Stewardship is the next thing you need. You need to be a good steward. When we lived in the village, we had a lot of neighbors that we tried to extend hospitality towards. A lot of these neighbors had little barbarians in their houses as well. And we went through this tension of how do we extend hospitality without having these little undisciplined barbarians that they were calling children ruin our house. And then we started thinking about it, you know, what do we care more about, our house or their eternal destiny? And that became tough. And then I realized, okay, God has given us our house. That's His stuff. The question then becomes, how does God want His stuff used? So we need to be good stewards of God's stuff, as well as the relationships and our neighbors and all the stuff that God has put in our life. We need to be good stewards of it because we're eventually giving an account for how we've used the stuff that God's put in our life. And we kind of resolved it. If, you know, the kids were basically breaking stuff, the conversation needed to get taken to a park or someplace where less damage could be done. It was actually in the kids' best interest to learn not to break other people's stuff, because nobody wants to invite you over if you break their stuff. Then we also started getting a little more durable furniture. You know, there are a lot of patterns that we like on stuff, and then we realized, you know, the leather couches we have in our house, they are made by a company called Steelcase. Because some of the other furniture we've had, even though we got a leather, so it wouldn't, you know, we got the 20-year protection on it, so you know, this stuff is like rhinoceros hide. It's actually water buffalo hide. You can't puncture it. You know, it's tough. But the underpinnings went. So then we went to Steelcase. And they're lasting. So people can jump up and down on the stuff, and, you know, it's less likely to break, and we can be a little more hospitable. There's a book that really helped us, and it's called Open Heart by an Open Home by Karen Maines. Karen and David Maines started a ministry to Chicago street kids. They weren't totally street kids, but it was kind of inner city Chicago. And they went through this struggle of, you know, these people are strangers to us. These people don't have the same set of values that we have. These people break our stuff. How do we deal with it? And she eventually came to the resolution reflected in the book called Open Heart, Open Home. If your heart's open to people, your home's open to people. And then she wound up writing a second book called The Key to an Open Heart, Open Home. And it's really the great stewardship perspective of God gives us the stuff and we need to use it for the benefit of others. So in the process of stewardship, it costs to minister to people. It costs time, as well as money, as well as your stuff. And you have to trust that God will provide what you need, and if you're out of pocket for it, He will make it up to you. Frequently in this life, definitely in the next. So you need that stewardship mentality. The third thing you need is confident grace. And it's that the confidence that God will provide the grace to endure the difficult situations as I interact with people, and also to confront the difficulty that arises in the midst of it. So rather than just build my wall of protection around my castle and say, no barbarians allowed, or to build my wall of protection around my life and say, no invaders allowed, I need to be able to trust that God will provide what I need. A verse that I frequently think of is 2 Corinthians 9, 6 through 8. It says, if you sow sparingly, you're going to reap sparingly, because you will reap what you sow. And the last part of it says, God is able to make all grace abound to you. He's God of all grace. So He's able to make it so it overflows in your life, so that you will always have all sufficiency for every good deed. Verse 4 says, you having all sufficiency, all that you need, can abound to every good work. Believe it or not, hospitality is a good work. Do good and share with such sacrifices God is pleased. So is it just having somebody over? Is that the good deed? Is that meritorious? Not really. Providing housing for someone who's just passing through, is that meritorious in God's sight? Maybe, maybe not. The key is what goes on as they are there. The conversations. God uses believers in the lives of other believers to help them become like Christ. And he does that usually through conversations. So in the process of extending hospitality, God provides the grace that you need to sometimes bring up difficult situations, even if, like, please have your child not swing from our chandelier, to issues more pertinent to the person's life. When we had our place up in the mountains open and set up better, we had people up almost every weekend. We would keep a book that would constantly get filled up of folks who came up. There isn't a lot of you that have been up there. And then we hit the teen years, and a number of other factors caused us to not be up there as frequently. But we had the opportunity to extend extreme hospitality. And we also had the opportunity to observe good guests and not so good guests. I think that we moved in, I can't remember what day we moved in, but God provided it so that we moved in like on a Wednesday. Jill got sainthood for this. And on that Friday, we had 20 people sleeping in the house. God provided all the linens, all the everything that we needed. He also provided all the people to use it. And he provided us with the grace to be able to have that happen. And, you know, this went on regularly. And we have, you know, lots of great experiences. We also have a lot of tough experiences where people never talk to us again after visiting with us. That's okay. They'll eventually have to talk to God about the issues. But we kind of understood what a good guest is. And if people are extending hospitality to you, here is how you can be a good guest. If you are extending hospitality to folks and they are not a good guest, you're going to have some answers down in number 3 about not grumbling or complaining. So we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But good guests communicate. They communicate ahead of time. I'm going to be there. I'm not going to be there. I'm running late. I remember we had this one thing set up where a person who was really a responsible guy who was going to come by for dinner with his son. It was all set up. We had the table all set. Dinner all made. We waited and waited and called. No answer. And called. No answer. And called. No answer. And a couple hours later, Jill and I had dinner with each other. It's a little cold. We never heard from them. They just, like, no communication. It's like, and this is like, you know, a major adult with, you know, major responsibilities. Just, I don't know what was going on. Haven't communicated much since then, but a good guest communicates ahead of time. While they're there, they communicate. I remember we had a couple of younger people over for a party, and there was this one young lady that kind of came because she was a sister of Shannon Britt's friends. And she was sitting by herself, nobody was paying attention to her, so I sat down and next door and started asking her questions and talking to her. I felt like a dentist pulling teeth. I could not get this person to utter more than a monosyllable. And this is a girl. You know, a guy I could have understood. You know. But this is a girl who had a sister, so I knew she knew how to talk. It's just like, and yeah, it just did not communicate. Good guests communicate. Good guests take an interest in their host. You know, it's like, enough about me, how about you? Why don't you talk about me? No, and good guests actually find out about the host. Yeah, it's a give and take, it's a communication, it's have in common, it's, you know, learn to discuss things. It's what's supposed to happen as life progresses. And then good guests also communicate afterwards. They send a note or even just an email, thanks. Or they brag about how good it was. You know, that's, hosts put in a lot of work. And even though God gives them their reward, you can brag about it as well. Good guests normally bring something. What can I bring? And I'm going to a 40th reunion of my freshman year in college next week. And this one couple's hosting it outside of Philly. And I keep asking, what can we bring? And they say, just bring your bathing suit. What can we bring? Bring your bathing suit and stay over. You know, I just kind of, this is really interesting because some of these guys I have not seen for 40 years, with good reason. And we're going to get together. But the person is actually extending huge hospitality. And you can pray for me for next weekend. See how that one goes. But you bring something. Even if the host says, oh, don't bring anything, for the most part, unless, you know, they are people that you kind of frequently have back and forth, it's always a good idea to bring something. If you bring flowers, make sure you find the vase to put it in. Because the hostess is running around doing a whole bunch of other stuff, and then everybody's coming and bringing flowers. Yeah, it's like, bring a bottle of wine. You're good, because they can just stay with us. Or whatever. All right, part three of this, on what to being a good guest, is serve. A lot of people, it's gotten to the point frequently where it's usually easier for us to serve others than to try to give them things to serve. One of our favorite guests to have up at Willowemoc was Misan. She was voted our guest of the year on multiple occasions. Because rather than saying, is there anything I can do? Which means, I really don't want to do anything, and I'm hoping you'll say no. She would say, oh, I can do that. Here, why don't you let me do that and have someone else do something else? So she would see that she could do something. She was other-centered. She observed that there was the need, and she would go to meet it. If the host says no, they'll get it. Do not rip the things out of their hand. Let them do the thing. That you are their guest, and you want to respect that. It doesn't take any special skills to clean up after a meal or put chairs away. You know, just that stuff. Like, you go to a party and then you leave the people with this huge house mess. And they say, oh, the maid will get it tomorrow. But you know that they're the maid. So if it's appropriate, serve. And don't be a burden and don't leave a trace. Take all your stuff with you. And none of their stuff. Silverware, ancient. Leave them where they are. Artwork stays on the walls. Don't steal their stuff. So, you know, good guests are like that. Basically, good guests are other-centered as well. Good guests practice hospitality in reverse in terms of thinking, how would I want to be treated if I was their host? So that's part of being a good guest. The benefit of practicing biblical hospitality are numerous. You get friends. You get blessings both here and hereafter. You get reward, and you actually accomplish ministry in someone's life. One of the more surprising judgments that occurs at the end of the age when Christ comes back has this line in it, that you're all familiar with it, the great white throne, sheep and goats getting separated. Matthew 25:34. Then the king, Jesus, as he comes back, will say to those on the right, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit as a reward the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. When God set up this world, his purpose was to have a kingdom come at the end of it. As you know, this is not the best of all possible worlds. There's lots that's wrong with it. And this world is the best way to the best of all possible worlds. The best of all possible worlds is still coming. It's the future kingdom, which righteousness dwells, in which noble character traits are rewarded, all that other good stuff. This is just the stage or proving ground for that. God's plan in laying the foundation of this world was to have a kingdom in the future in which God's purposes and promises are fulfilled by those who are faithful to him. And then he says, I was a stranger, a Xenos, and you took me in. And he goes on, I was in prison and you visited me, and all this other good stuff. And they're going to say, huh? When did we do these things to you, Lord? And you all know the parable, the story. It's actually prophecy. He said, as you did it to one of the least of these my brethren, you did it to me. Whoever gives a cup of water to a disciple in my name will surely not lose their reward. What's litotes? It's an understatement. By saying you surely won't lose, it means you're surely going to get it. Which is why I'm really fond of passing out water bottles, because, hey, you know, each one of these, who knows? So, doing things, notice to whom you do them. Other believers. For some reason, this gets missed by lots of people. They think, oh, we're supposed to love all those people out there and ignore all the people in here. No, no, no. It's the least of my brethren. Some people say it was just limited to the Jews. But based on the rest of the New Testament, hospitality, love is to one another, and we extend ourselves to that. I skipped C on the motivation. Bummer, getting old here. The motivation for extending this is not just reward, but so God will look good in the eyes of others. This is what it means to glorify Him. Matthew 5:16. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good deeds, they may see your hospitality, and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Whatever you do, do it to the glory of God. So that should be our motivation. God's glory. God's glory actually gets manifested as He rewards those who are faithful. It shows that He can give us good stuff. So they tie together. Little sidebar under C. I was thinking of almost dropping this one out, but it was just fun to study it. As I looked on the online Bible, you can all do this at home or any of the programs that list Strong's numbers. The word for the stranger lover shows up about 5 times. If you look up the first part, philos, the word for love, it shows up as a noun about 25 times, a couple dozen, or a little more, 29, and a verb 25 times. And it even is the word for kiss. 7 times it shows up for that. And I thought, gee, I wonder what it is in the New Testament world that people loved. So just a little sidebar, no extra charge for this piece. Don't pay attention to it. I'll wake you up when it's over. Just turn to a screen. But a lover of good once, a lover of brothers 7 times, a lover of husband once, mankind twice, money 3 times, a lover of self. I'm surprised it didn't show up more than once. A lover of pleasure. A lover of horses 6 times. That's because Philippi means love horses. So they must have had a couple tracks at Philippi. So you know, they weren't actually people loving Philippi. They were the people from Philippi who were the horse lovers. Lover of God, I was surprised to see that only show up but once as a guy's name. I think it's like in the Romans. A lover of the word, just once. Wow. Lover of strife, 2 times. Lover of strangers, that's us, 5 times, stranger lover. Lover of preeminence, bad, once. Wisdom, twice. Affection, once. Children, once. Honor, 3 times. And having been friendly-minded, it's like a fellow-minded, it's twice. So there's lots of different things that you can love. You want to be loving the things that God loves, and those happen to be other people. So hospitality is where you can extend that. So you want to do that in light of the judgment when Christ comes back. That happens to be one of the criteria on which people get judged. Third Epistle of John, one of those tiny, tiny, tiny little ones, right in the back of your Bible before Revelation, he is commending the host of one of the, this guy that he's writing to, and he says, "You do faithfully whatever you do for the brethren and for strangers who are borne witness of your love before the church." So here this guy was, he let the church come into his house. People who were being persecuted, he took them in. Traveling preachers, he took them in. And then they testified that he loved them by showing hospitality to them. And then John goes on to say, if you send them out in a manner worthy of God, you will do well. We therefore ought to receive such that we may become fellow workers for the truth. The amazing principle that comes out of this passage is by simply demonstrating hospitality, particularly to those who are itinerant preachers coming through, you share in their work. And you share in their blessing. So those who hold ropes also get the benefit of those who jump over the cliff to rescue some. Luke 16:9, Jesus said, "Make friends for yourselves by the unrighteous mammon." So when the unrighteous mammon fails, the friends that you made with it may receive you into an everlasting home. He goes on to say that he who is faithful in that which is least, the use of mammon, is faithful also in that which is much, which is your future reward. So you get friends out of the thing, you get blessings, you get rewarded, and you have great opportunities for ministry by inviting people over. And I know I'm preaching to the choir here because you guys are an exceptional group of having people over. So, now that you got that out of the way, let's talk about part 2. Grumbling, murmuring, complaining, fussing, whining. Nothing. So since Chantilly's been home, there have been times when I've been grumbling just at life. And she'll remind me, no grumbling. So then I'll start, no murmuring. And I'll say, I'm murmuring, I'm complaining. She says, not that either. And we kind of go down to like whining, and then I'll do the sniffing part. And really, it's just like micro-rebellion is still rebellion. Even though we manage to mitigate the effects of it and the outward signs of it, it still is a discontent and rebellion against God. Now, the original context of the source is you extend hospitality to people without begrudging them the stuff that you're extending to them. Okay, it's God's stuff, use it for God's stuff. I want to talk here a little bit about something that we probably have a little more trouble with, and that's called this grumbling thing. We grumble because we don't like the way things are going. So I give you a biblical definition of this concept. Not a biblical, my definition. It's a Bill definition. But it summarizes, I think, most of the biblical data on it. Murmuring arises from a distrust and discontent with God's provision and plans. I don't like what God's provided. You'll see where this comes from in a couple minutes. I don't like where He's going. So I'm going to grumble. I'm not going to outwardly rebel. I'm not going to walk away from Him. I'm just going to grumble. I don't like it. And that's not good. It's caused by a distorted perspective. You just don't see things from God's perspective. That's why you grumble. You don't recognize that it's God's plan for good. You don't recognize all the blessings that God has poured out on you. Job says, should we receive good from the Lord and not evil? I don't know if you guys remember the song we sung earlier about We Are Family. One of the reasons I like that song, despite the fact that it keeps going higher and higher, is it just is a biblical song of all the blessings God has given us. Being part of the family of God is one of them. But there's this huge number of biblical truth, numbers of biblical truth in that song. And if we don't see that God has blessed us with all this great stuff and appreciate it, we will distrust and be discontent. And if our values haven't been changed and we still have the demonically influenced world values, that this life is all there is and it all revolves around us and we got to get as much as we can and have things our way, then we will have a distorted perspective and we will be discontent. And this is not good. Because do you know how God treats discontented believers? Oh, it's not pretty. It results in displeasing God, deprivation. God deprives you of things. Not just the blessings He would have given you and the intimacy of His presence, but you're actually going to lose stuff that you have. I'll see in a second. And you get discipline. That's owie and pain. You get discipline now. New Testament believers, you are not immune to what's coming. 1 Corinthians 11 says, believers, we're not being other-centered at the Lord's Supper. For this reason, there are many sick and dying among you. God was sending judgment to New Testament church because of their carnality towards each other. You thought Ananias and Sapphira was just the beginning? You're right. It's the beginning. It continues. And in the future, actually a couple more verses in 1 Peter 4, we're going to see there's judgment for believers. Judgment begins at the house of God. So there's divine discipline that happens down the road. A passage that I don't think is in most people's Bibles is 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Everybody skips it. I never hear this. Nobody talks about this. It basically says that the stuff in the Old Testament was written down for us to warn us not to do certain things. Otherwise, we're going to lose. Now, all of you have read your Bible. All of you have read 1 Corinthians 10. Some of you might have even memorized it. Yet most of you would probably not be able to tell me what are the events talked about in 1 Corinthians 10. 1 Corinthians 10 says, I don't want you to be ignorant, brothers, that everybody in the Old Testament was under the cloud, under Moses. They all drank of the same spiritual rock, which is Christ. They were believers as you and I are today. And then it says in 1 Corinthians 10:5, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. These things became examples to the intent that we should not desire or lust after evil things as they also lusted. The passage that's being referred to is Numbers 13. Most of you probably know what that's about. Some of you might not. Now, for those of you who don't know what that is, just think about this. You've read this passage. It said something happened in the Old Testament that was written down for our benefit so that you don't set your heart on the wrong things. So, what are those wrong things? You have to go back to look at the context to figure out what's the wrong thing and make sure you don't do the same thing that they did. You know what the wrong thing they did was? They refused to go into the promised land and take on the giants. They were concerned about their own safety and the safety of their kids. And you know what God calls that? Evil. And as a result, two guys out of that entire generation survived. Joshua and Caleb, middle names of my boys. There's two guys. With most of them, God was not well pleased. Well, gee, it looks like he was actually not pleased with any of them except two. Narrow is the way that leads to life. Few are the ones who find it. Broad's the way that leads to destruction. And we're not talking about going to heaven or hell. We're talking about being blessed or cursed in the future. So Numbers 13, they were fearful. They rebelled. They were looking for their security. They were looking for their comfort. We need to burn this lesson into our minds so we don't fall into the same trap, because we're going to be doubly judged, because God says in other spots, don't do this stuff. And then he said, I even wrote down this example for you in the New Testament so you wouldn't do it. The other thing he doesn't want you to do is commit idolatry. I don't think most of you struggle with having a little God shelf in your corner of your closet. Or you ask, oh, what's that? Oh, nothing, absolutely nothing. So anyway, we went on a college tour of a Christian college, and the kid had up in his apartment, a room, when they gave us the tour, a God shelf, complete with candles and incense and little figurines and the whole thing. And you'd say, well, I would never commit idolatry. Yeah, but many people do. Did you know greed is considered idolatry in the list of sins in Galatians? It's using something other than God as a substitute for God. Getting your worth, your value, your jollies from something other than God and God's provision. So Exodus 32 shows that they were disobeying, distrusting God. The incident there, he actually quotes the passage that gets quoted by Paul about them rising up to play, sitting down, eating, drink, occurred in Exodus 32. It's the golden calf. God's not there. God's not doing what we want. I mean, God let us out, sure. He killed the Egyptians, sure. He put us in the Red Sea, sure. He gave us water, sure. He gave us manna, sure. But he's not doing what we want now, so we're going to look somewhere else. And God smote a whole bunch of them. Nor, verse 9, tempt Christ as some of them tempted and were destroyed by serpents. This is the reference, John 3:16. Right before that, it talks about the serpents. So you should have known this one out of that passage. Or reading this, you say, boy, how do you tempt Christ? I don't want to tempt Christ. So how do you do it? You put him to the test. How do you put him to the test? Try him. They were complaining over their food. They were discontent with what God had provided. They doubted that God was going to have their best interest at heart. They said, oh, he's brought us out into the wilderness to kill us. And I'm sure Jesus is up there saying, hold me back, Gabriel, hold me back. And he basically smites them with the fiery serpents until they repented. But then verse 10 says, we should not complain as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. So you should have gone back, and if you've ever read this passage, and said, if this was written down for my instruction, what was it that they complained about? And if you go back, and the thing that most people, the same word is used for complain, it's one of the few times it's used in the Old Testament, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, it comes out of this one, it's the most likely one, is in Numbers 16. And this is a spot where Moses and Aaron are there ministering, and a bunch of their compatriots say, well, God doesn't just speak through you. And, you know, we can offer fire and incense just like you can. And they say, okay, let's put it to the test. So they all get their incense together. They all offer it. And God, I think, kind of causes the ground to open up and swallow them up, or some fire comes from heaven and they all melt. And he said, okay, any more questions? Moses is my man. Now, what happened there? God supernaturally intervened from heaven to judge those who were rebelling. The effect on those who saw it? They complained. Can you believe this? And you know what their complaint is? Moses, you've caused the death of God's people. And Moses is there, what did I do? What did I do? It's like, clearly God does it. A lot of the complaints are irrational. And then God smites the people with, I forget what, you know, maybe this is where the earth opens, or it's just like 7,000 or some huge number of folks get smited. Why? Because they were doubting God's just discipline. They were complaining that God's justice was being carried out. And now it goes on to say, these things happened to them as examples, and they were written down for our admonition. A couple weeks ago I talked about admonition. You put people in mind of the consequences. That's what warning and admonition is all about. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. So, God's recorded these instructions, recorded these examples, so we wouldn't do this stuff, because we wouldn't get judged. Now, a lot of people think, oh, I trusted Christ, everything's good. Yeah, everything's good, except now you have to live faithfully, and there's a judgment coming based on whether or not you've been faithful. So you want to be faithful. In Jude, such one little chapter there, verse 14, he says, behold, the Lord comes, and he's going to execute judgment on all, everyone. Just like the judgment of Matthew 25 was on everyone. He's going to convict all who are ungodly of all their ungodly deeds committed in an ungodly way, and of all the ungodly sinners who have spoken their ungodly law. These are grumblers and complainers walking according to their own lusts. And we always kind of paint these characters as folks that are, you know, these sniveling, stinky, grubby people that are hanging out at the peep shows on 42nd Street or wherever they happen to be now. It's not them. It's us. Not that we're doing that. But it's, we have a lust or desire for what we want. We need to lust for what God wants. Otherwise, we're going to complain when we don't get our way. And that's going to set us up for judgment that we should be spared. Philippians 2:12, Paul says, yeah, as you've always obeyed, continue, work out your salvation, your own salvation, with fear and trembling. Just talking about your sanctification, glorification, not getting your sins forgiven. The reason you should do this with fear and trembling is because God is at work in you to will and to do His good pleasure. One of my favorite verses. It's, the Spirit of God dwells within us, causes us to desire as well as to do what pleases God. Now, that's the reason why we should work out our salvation with fear and trembling, because if we don't cooperate with Him, bad things will happen. And if you do, you may become blameless, harmless children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. I don't know if any of you have that as your objective, blameless and harmless without fault in the midst of a bunch of whining, grumbly, complaining, sniffling, fussing, walking after our own lust kind of people that live around us. Among them you shine as lights in the world. Wow. Let your light shine before men. As you flesh out the word of life. So Paul would rejoice that in the day of Christ's judgment, he hasn't run or labored in vain. Here Paul is looking forward to his reward. He wants the Philippians to be lights in the midst of darkness. By their behavior, by their wholehearted service of the Lord, by their working without grumbling or complaining, without fussing, by having the joy that comes through them. For those of you who don't know this, Philippians is all about joy comes from choosing what's best. They would be attractive to Christ. And then Paul says, I want that to happen because I don't want to have wasted my time. Interesting perspective on Paul. So we had Paul, we got Jude. James has a little line on this. A little verse that's almost stuck in there out of context that I frequently just skip over. But it says, do not grumble against one another, brethren. Believer, do not grumble against another believer, lest you be condemned. Basically, it has, have a judgment against you. Katakrino. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. So in James, this is the end of James, he says, Jesus is coming back to judge, endure, do what you're supposed to. And he throws in a specific thing about not grumbling or complaining against your brethren, because we can be judged for it. So to get back to the definition under Roman rule 3, murmuring, grumbling, complaining, etc., comes from distrust and discontent with God's provision and plans. It's caused by having a distorted perspective on life and what we're here for, and it results in displeasing God and its consequent judgment. So a wise person would probably not do it. Just as a little sidebar, this does not mean that you can't talk about faults, because the fervent love turns a sinner from their way and covers over a multitude of sins. It doesn't mean that you can't say things that are negative. It just means that you're not complaining about the treatment. You can just be sharing information. A lot of it's how you do it rather than what you actually do. I'm sure I'll get more questions on that. So, time for questions. Yeah, thanks.
One quick point, one question. With Abraham and Sarah, who entertained strangers, three strangers, one of them, most people believe, was Jesus Christ himself. So, when we do entertain strangers as invitations, that's my segue to my question. In the world we live in today in Manhattan, in this world, there are times that I feel like there are people that you should give money to because they're needy, and you know that as soon as they get it, they're going to walk down the street and either buy drugs or buy alcohol. You also know if you took two people into your house may not be there and somebody might get killed in the process. Nonetheless, the Good Samaritan example suggests that we not only have an obligation to our brothers, but we have obligations to complete strangers. How do we reconcile these seemingly conflicting issues that good Christians address within any city?
Right, when I first came to New York, staying out in New Jersey, and going from the third floor of Port Authority down to the street, one day I counted 12 people that I had to step over around who were begging or just passed out on the stairs. 12.
Only 12?
That was... it was like just the free flights. That's like... Alright, so I could have spent all my time there.
And money.
Yeah. Except they didn't have much money, so it was pretty easy. Nothing. So there's a priority of what we have to do. We have priorities to God, being a good steward of His stuff. The question that I asked under hospitality is, how does God want His resources spent? There's also, on the follow-up line to that, accomplishing God's purpose in the life of others. For the most part, one of the most helpful things that you can do to someone is help them reap the consequences of their actions. Otherwise, we're just enabling them. So giving money to street people who just use it to get drunk, we used to give a lot stuff to people when we first came to the city, and eventually we realized this is probably not really helpful because none of the stories eventually panned out, and none of the stuff ever got repaid. And if we just enable a person to continue in sin, how is that love? So we want to use God's resources, God's way, to accomplish God's purposes in another's life, which calls for discernment. Now, fortunately, the Spirit of God's at work in us causes us to willing to do His good pleasure. God, what do you want me to do? And for the most part, the answer has been, keep going. You've got work to do. Then the priority is to believers. So I first try to address the commands that I'm really sure of. Okay, I know what a believer looks like. I know how I can extend hospitality to them, and I do so. The random stranger thing, it's like, I remember I was doing a wedding, and the minister at the church who was there just for the money said, oh yeah, minister of Manhattan, it's just like ministering to a parade. Isn't it great? And I'm thinking, no, that isn't great. I want to make disciples. I want to make people reproductive so they can teach others also like Jesus commanded. So ministering to a parade is not in my Bible, but making disciples is. So after I finish making disciples, if I have time, I'll think about ministering to a parade. So it's purposeful, sound-minded, objective ministry under the guidance of the Holy Spirit knocks out most of that stuff. And there are times we prayed for God to send people into our lives who had needs. And it was really funny. One time we did this, and we got to visit my mom, and there on our doorstep is someone who had need, that was a friend of the family, abusive husband, left her. She started a business. One of her biggest clients went bankrupt. She was left holding a bag. She didn't have enough money for ingredients. And we realized, okay, this is God giving us this person. So we were able to minister. You know, God provides those opportunities. Another thought is that we support some of the street missions, like the Colley Water Street Mission or the New York Rescue Mission. And we used to try to hand out those cards that you get as a donor, but people didn't want them. Like, you know, I don't want a free meal. I want a handout. So there's a hierarchy. And by and large, you're not commanded to take axe murderers into your house. But you are commanded to demonstrate biblical hospitality to other believers. And, you know, after I finish doing that, I'll think about the axe murderers. But right now, I'm too busy. Yeah, Steve.
So, Timothy 2, Jude says, so let's just say, for example, there's a believer that I know that loves to watch football or basketball or BBC. And you invite them over and they sit on the couch and they watch BBC. And there's no sort of conversation and you kind of want to hang out fellowship. How do you balance, you'll have, scant resources for the time?
Yeah, it's another. You want to accomplish God's purposes in that person's life. God's purpose is not for them to continue being plugged into their drug. So by enabling them, you become a sharer in their sin. So I wouldn't have that person over if that's all they're going to do. I would say, let's go for a walk or do something else. Try to have some conversation. If there's no profitable conversation and we're just talking about trivial stuff, like, I have to give an account for how I've spent that time when I get to heaven. And, just sharing in your sin. Jesus didn't just party with pagans because he enjoyed partying with pagans. He partied with pagans so he could confront them with truth. If they're not interested in with truth, he did not continue partying with pagans. He went on somewhere else. And he even didn't hang with believers just for the sake of hanging with believers. He said, I'm going to go to the next town. Wait, where's Jesus going? Well, Jesus is going, I'm going. And then you had a fellowship with people who were willing to follow Jesus, as opposed to the crowd that just said, Jesus, if you come back next week, I'll be here maybe. Imagine you get to sleep on time. So there's just like a world of difference between that. So we don't give people just something just because they want it. We give it to them because it's God's purpose is being accomplished in their life. Yes?
Yeah, associated with that is the issue of timing, which is you may have somebody who started that way. There's a transition time.
Right.
And that's also predetermined wisdom. So you see the 3 years that Jesus spent with his disciples. They didn't get it until the end. And then you've got, follow me to the next town. It was a very hard and fast command that he had followed and were left behind. So how do you guys?
Initially, the disciples were willing to follow, and they did. They didn't get it all in terms of what was supposed to happen, but they were willing to follow. So, you know, my favorite thing is what I call dropping breadcrumbs of truth. And I see if people are hungry if they're interested in doing it. And now, I always got to have a proviso on this. If there aren't more people than you know how to deal with, then you need to work on developing your relationships with those people first. And then you need to be spending time with God so that you have some discernment in terms of what are God's purposes for another person's life. And since God uses people to minister to other people, He gives us insight into people's needs so we can help accomplish His purposes. And then we say, are you interested in having God's purposes fulfilled in your life? And when the answer becomes no, the fellowship becomes negligible. Because we don't have anything in common. I got God in common with other people. I have your needs in common for this short time frame. And, you know, if there are people that I, you know, happen to be in long-term contact with, then there's a lot more grace extended. But sometimes that grace is indulgence, which is not good. So it's all that discernment thing. Yeah, Garrett.
The list of verbs at point three, could you add sighing and eyeball rolling?
I don't know. I didn't want to get to meddling. You know, that goes beyond preaching when you get to meddling. Now, eyeball rolling is a really fine art, well-acquired skill that some people have perfected over the years, and it would just be a shame to see that go to waste, as well as the glare. I know some people that have just got that glare down. And it's like, I didn't see anything about glare in the Bible. Yeah, those would be good things to put in there. In fact, eyeball rolling is a sign of contempt. And when Gottman, in his research on relationships, saw that on his videotapes, it was one of those instant predictors of a marriage that would not last because there was eyeball rolling and it was contempt. And, you know, it's like contempt is easy to... I mean, you have to know someone well to be contemptuous of them. So it's a sign that a relationship isn't working like it should.
And sighing is probably a sign of
discipline. Sometimes it's just a sigh of frustration. Yeah, I sigh a lot. Yeah, it's, oh, not this again. You know, it should be, oh, good, this again. Yeah, I'm just not there yet. Yes? No, and yes. Some of my friends say yes, some of my friends say no, and I'm for my friends. I'm answering that one. There are priorities. The person who neglects their husband and, or the late woman, let's get real personal, who neglects their husband and their kids and their church and their God-given responsibilities for entertaining, because I like having people over, is going to be really surprised at the judgment seat that they get smacked because they weren't following the Spirit of God and His commands. On the other hand, those who hide behind their husband and their kids and their other responsibilities and don't do it will also wind up getting disciplined because they wind up disobeying God. So the idea is you need to be sensitive. A lot of times our thinking of hospitality is Martha Stewart. It doesn't have to be. It can be a glass of water or dessert or something simple. You know, in the couple's Bible study, you know, we start out with dinner and then we went down to just dessert because it became, you know, just too much. Excuse me? Yeah, just do water next. Yeah, it's the whole Martha Mary thing. So, you know, if you're too busy being a Martha, you need to be more of a Mary. But the idea is that you hit your priorities, and there's times when God's will might be to have people over, and there are times when it's God's will to not have people over. So you need to be sensitive to what that is. It's not, ministry is not a, these are the five principles that, or rules that you need to follow. They're principles, but the biggie is I need to be sensitive to accomplishing God's purposes in another's life. What are those purposes? So just having people over, that doesn't really hack it. You need to have your home together in order to have people over. So if you can never have people over, then you might want to think about, why is it that I can't get my home together? And then you'll, you know, you might discover there are things that can be done. Because my kids totally drain me. Okay, why do my kids totally drain me? Well, it might be because my roommate isn't cooperative. You know, or because, you know, there are lots of reasons for why it is. So basically, the family unit has to get together when you have kids to make the thing happen. Otherwise, it doesn't really happen well. Or if it happens, it happens at the expense of higher commands, and that's, you know, insanity to trade a higher objective for a lower objective. Can I answer that? Yeah, Chet.
So 1 Corinthians 10:9. When you complain and grumble, do we have higher servants in our lives, or is that more of a future judgment day?
When we complain and grumble, do we have
fire serpents in our lives? Do we see them, or is it more of a future judgment day?
I got bitten the other day. I don't know if that counts. Oh, I should have said, that's a good question. God's gracious. He didn't nail the nation of Israel until it reached time number 10, and 10 was a symbol of completion. And then he said, you're toast. No more. So we might not get the fiery serpents every single time, but they're there, and they're coming. And the God of the fiery serpents of 1500 BC is the same God of the fiery serpents today. So they just come in different forms. There's also Satan who can send serpents to destruct us. Yeah, that's what he does. So again, it's that discernment as to what are God's purposes. That's why the safest thing to do is to always go to the principle level, saying, is this doing God's work or my own work? Is this doing what pleases Him or pleases me? If it's what pleases me and I get bitten, duh, I need to learn from it. If I'm trying to please God and I get bitten, then it's like, all right, God, you'll give me the grace, you'll make it up. If there are no fiery serpents, I'm doing fine. Not true. There's that proverb about God, I mean, that psalm, that God sets the wicked on high, lets them get exceedingly wicked, lets it happen multiple times, get them up to the top of the mountain so we can just get them off of one really good swat. And then you see, bad guy fell. Aha. All right, so he doesn't get you right as you're going up the wrong path. He waits until you're obviously there and then squat. Okay, food here yet? Oh, wow. Any of these questions worth doing? Yeah, they're all good. You can read on your own. Why don't we close in prayer and then we can talk. Heavenly Father, thank you that you are a God who provides for us. That's what you do. Thank you that you provide instruction, help, encouragement, fellowship, all manner of things that are useful for us. Thank you for the ways that you provide through hospitality. Thank you for the hospitality I've received in the hands of this body and been able to extend as well. And from extending that to the friendships and relationships that I've developed. Thank you that you call us to this, because we know that if you call to it, you give us grace for it. Thank you that your grace is all sufficient. And Father, I pray that you would help us have your perspective on things so that when stuff comes into our life that we might not prefer, we could respond in such a way that we would still be lights, drawing others to you and you being glorified. Help us have discernment for the various needs that are around us so that we do what pleases you. Bless our fellowship with each other. May it be pleasing in your sight. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen.